Hello, and welcome to the Critical Voter Podcast. My name is Jonathan Haber. When we left off last week, I was about to walk through an example of how to use the principles of information literacy to obtain the background knowledge needed to think critically about a topic. For this exercise, I decided to use a political example, but I chose to go outside the presidential campaign in favor of selecting one many people who follow critical thinking in the news will be familiar with, last summer's hubbub over the Texas Republican Party's alleged attempt to ban critical thinking from the curriculum. I chose this example because, in addition to providing a topic that we can unpack using the information literacy tools discussed last week, locating information, evaluating information, and the like, it's also a useful example to demonstrate how biases can interfere with our attempt to find and qualify the information needed to achieve understanding. And that's because these biases can come from more than one place. For example, since this issue involves one of the major political parties, there'll be an obvious desire by partisans from the other major party to portray the story in a way that makes their rivals come off as badly as possible. But there are other potential biases at work here also, notably the bias of people who, like me, attach great importance to the teaching of critical thinking, who react poorly to any attempt to marginalize or stigmatize the field. So let's see how this plays out as we try to find out exactly what went on in Texas last summer. To start with, before we type a single word into a single search engine, we need to form our goal into a question. So in this case, my question is going to be, did the Texas Republican Party attempt to ban the teaching of critical thinking in the public schools? Armed with this question, I can now step up to the keyboard and perform a Google search based on the most obvious keywords associated with this subject, Texas Republicans critical thinking. This search brings up a tidy 15.9 million results from the open web. There must be something in this close to 16 million web documents I can make use of, right? Probably, but enough to achieve sufficiency? That is enough information that passes our various quality tests to ensure our questions get answered? Let's see. To begin with, if you look over the first several pages of links that come up in this search, you can immediately see that Google has ranked sources with high authority, such as well-known newspapers and magazines, and strong opinions. And for the most part, these come from harsh critics of the Texas GOP, which means we should be on the lookout for the bias I just mentioned. Texas GOP rejects critical thinking, really, announces the Washington Post. No more critical thinking in schools, pronounces a blog on Education Week. The terrifying Republican platform, denounces Forbes magazine. The first page also includes links to some stories where the chair of the Texas GOP explains this controversial measure, and a couple of stories characterizing this decision as an accident. But rather than begin by reading condemnations or defenses, it might be better to find out what this decision actually consisted of. And so I've chosen a link to the Austin Chronicle, a newspaper that probably gives more coverage to Texas party politics than Education Week or Forbes. And while the story also criticizes the party for its decision, it also spells out what the Texas Republicans actually did. As it turns out, the GOP did not propose legislation to ban critical thinking or take any other sort of legislative action targeting critical thinking or any other subject, but rather included a plank in its party platform regarding the matter. Since that party maintains its own site in the open web, my next search is for the actual text of the 2012 Texas Republican platform, which, interestingly enough, doesn't appear until page 2 of a Google search for those words, behind a host of many of the same critiques I found in my first search. And one quick find command later, I've located the information I was looking for. A paragraph amidst a host of others relating to education which reads, quote, knowledge-based education. We oppose the teaching of higher-order thinking skills, parentheses HOTS, value clarification, critical thinking skills, and similar programs that are simply a relabeling of outcome-based education, OBE, mastery learning, which focuses on behavior modification and have the purpose of challenging the student's fixed beliefs and undermining parental authority. Okay, so now we've got something to work with. For one thing, we're dealing with a plank in a party platform. And if you've got some background knowledge on how party platforms are created, you know that platform creation has devolved in recent decades to the place where partisans charged up about a particular issue often include extreme language that is later ignored or criticized by mainstream party members. Just ask the National Democrats and Republicans, who both had to deal with unanticipated conflicts over platform issues at their recent conventions. Beyond these inter-party dynamics, we should also realize that the platform statement quoted above, which represents the argument decision-makers behind this plank are making, is not attacking critical thinking education per se. Rather, they're saying there exists a bad education method called higher-order thinking skills, rebranding of something called outcome-based education, which hides its real agenda, behavior modification, and undermining of fixed beliefs, behind the virtuous facade of critical thinking education. Now, it may turn out that this argument is dead wrong, but even if it is, we need to recognize that we are dealing with a different issue than an attempt to ban the teaching of critical thinking to Texas students. Rather, we are dealing with an argument that implies a question those of us who favor the teaching of critical thinking shouldn't automatically dismiss, which is, do teaching strategies that do not involve the teaching of critical thinking, or worse, fad or quack educational theories, try to take advantage of the halo effect associated with critical thinking to their own advantage? In case you're wondering, the halo effect is a strategic rhetorical device used to associate your cause with something your audience already feels positively disposed towards, which is why so many partisans from both parties like to invoke the Founding Fathers or Martin Luther King in their speeches. Getting back to our analysis, the Texas GOP's criticism seems to ultimately center on something called outcome-based education, or OBE. So the next stop in my search campaign will be to find out more about this subject using outcome-based education in quotes for my next keyword search. And as expected, the first link that comes up when I search this topic in Google comes from Wikipedia. Those who follow the Critical Voter blog know I recommend avoiding Wikipedia for any subject that smacks of political controversy. So as tempting as it might be to click on that link, or to one of the many links that talk about controversies related to OBE that appear on the first pages of Google, I'm instead going to log onto my public library's website, where they maintain access to a number of those professionally edited and scholarly information databases I mentioned last week, to see if I can get a handle on what OBE is really all about. A search through those databases, which are no harder to use than Google, gives me a long literature about both OBE and the controversies surrounding it. While we don't have enough time to go through all this material, the upshot seems to be that outcome-based education was once a conservative proposal to measure the success of education by outputs, student achievement of certain skills, versus inputs, spending per student, classroom size, and the like. And given that standardized testing, which is designed to measure outcomes, is now a cornerstone of public education, it looks like this education theory succeeded in going mainstream, which is why we now measure school success based on test scores rather than spending levels. But, at least according to critics, OBE lost its way when those outcomes became defined not in terms of knowledge and skills mastered, but in terms of behaviors and beliefs. As one critic put it, today's outcomes, quote, show little concern for core academic content, describing instead mental processes such as attitudes, dispositions, and sentiments. In short, the focus was on behavioral and social outcomes rather than knowledge and skills. Now, understand the nature of this controversy doesn't let the Texas GOP off the hook. After all, their attitude towards OBE are rather narrow. There are other opinions on the subject, after all. And they do seem to be conflating a number of educational ideas, OBE, higher-order thinking skills, mastery learning, critical thinking, etc., into a single issue. Now, while many people, including many educators, may also be confused over what these modern educational theories are and how they fit together, most of us have not assigned ourselves the task of denouncing them in an important political forum. Now that I have a better understanding of the issues involved, I'm ready to go back to some of my original search results, including criticism of the decision, with a focus on sources that actually cover the Texas GOP convention, such as Texas newspapers, and explanations of that decision, such as the interview I mentioned with the head of the Texas GOP. I could, if I wanted to, reach out to one of the journalists who cover the convention, or either the head of the Texas GOP or a spokesperson for more firsthand detail. Both the newspaper and Texas GOP site have contact us links I could use to connect to the sources closer to the ground. But even without doing this or any further research, I believe we have finally achieved sufficiency with regard to having enough information to answer our question. If you recall, the original question was, did the Texas Republican Party attempt to ban the teaching of critical thinking in the public schools? The answer to which is no. They included a plank in their platform criticizing the use of other teaching methods, either higher-order thinking skills or outcome-based education, which they claim do not actually teach critical thinking, but instead use critical thinking as a cover for their own nefarious agenda. But as our research showed, this equating of OBE, HOTS, mastery learning, critical thinking, and the like reflects confused thinking on important educational topics. And the fact that Texas leaders are ready to give, at best, muddled thinkers the chance to shape their party platform on the subject reflects both a lack of concern for understanding before acting, as well as a tin ear for how this story would play out in the media. In other words, even if their goal was to highlight the evils of outcome-based education, The choice of wording for their platform plank made it all but inevitable that they would be denounced as Neanderthals, looking to banish the ability to think critically from the brains of Texas students. Now for partisans who have either anti-Republican or pro-critical thinking education bias, notice that this analysis actually leaves us plenty of room to criticize the Texas Republican Party and their platform. I'll admit it doesn't support some of the more caustic and self-flattering statements I read that characterize those behind this decision as boobs, bumpkins, and dimwits, as opposed to we sophisticates who appreciate the importance of critical thinking, even if we too are unfamiliar with debates over outcome-based education and other reform efforts. And notice that this more appropriate criticism, that it was left to people who didn't understand what they were talking about to craft sloppy language that would be identified with the party as a whole, could have come from people who agree with the sentiment the GOP platform group was trying to convey, who are probably appalled that their issue has been made a laughingstock through the inappropriate use of the phrase critical thinking. As we finish off with this topic, take a look at how all the principles of information literacy helped us achieve understanding. I located information, not just on the open web, but in library databases, with a focus on sources closest to the ground, who I had the option of contacting directly for more information if I wanted to. When evaluating these sources, I selected scholarly ones to give me impartial information on some subjects, and partisan ones to help me better understand the issues being debated. This information was organized well enough to synthesize into a work product, this podcast, which I am in the process of communicating with you as you listen to it right now. Okay, with that example finishing off our discussion of information literacy, I'd like to spend the rest of this time talking about another subject not normally assumed to be a critical thinking skill, math. Wait, come back! And don't panic, for I'm actually not so much talking about math as about numbers and the extraordinary power they have to persuade us. I thought about this when a respected lecturer in math education, or perhaps it's maths education since he's from Canada, sent me a book called Proofiness by Charles Seif, which is subtitled The Dark Arts of Mathematical Deception. Well, I thought the book could have been stronger if the author had gotten into the actual math in more detail. Seif did an excellent job pointing out psychological and cultural factors behind our near religious faith in quantitative information. In Western culture, this faith goes back to our old friends, the ancient Greeks. While most students only know of the early mathematician Pythagoras through his famous geometry formula of a squared plus b squared equals c squared, with a and b being the lengths of the legs of a right triangle and c being the hypotenuse, Pythagoras was also a philosopher, some would say a cult leader, whose followers joined him in believing in the near mystical power of numbers, mathematics, and geometry. While some stories regarding Pythagoras are likely myths, such as the one saying he had a thigh made of gold and could perform feats of magic, the historical Pythagoras, or at least his philosophy, certainly seemed to have influenced Plato, whose work can be seen as trying to find equivalence in human life to the perfection of numbers. For when you think about it, numbers are not only perfect, but represent some of the only perfect things we encounter in life. Words change their meaning, people their nature, mountains can be leveled with an earthquake, and great lakes can dry up, but 2 plus 2 will always equal 4. That is true wherever you live and whatever culture you belong to, and will continue to be true even if you choose not to believe it. I don't think it was an accident when in the novel 1984, George Orwell uses an example of total submission to Big Brother, getting someone to both swear and truly believe that 2 plus 2 equaled 5, since this represents a denial of one of the few absolute truths we can conceive of as human beings. A problem arises, however, once you take that number out of its abstract realm of perfection and drag it down to the real world by attaching a unit to it. As Seif points out, 2 plus 2 may equal 4, but what happens when you add the length of two pieces of wood, each of which is 2 inches? Well, if you've got a good enough ruler, it will turn out that neither of those pieces of wood are exactly 2 inches long. Both will be slightly longer or shorter, even if only by a fraction of a fraction of an inch, which means if you add those alleged 2s together, you won't get 4, you'll get a number that is slightly less or more than 4. At first, this might seem like a ridiculous concern. After all, we have to accept a certain level of inexactitude as irrelevant if we want to measure a piece of wood to build a cabinet, as well as do most of the other things we do in our lives that involve measurement and practical arithmetic. But what happens when the level of uncertainty introduced when numbers get applied to real things become not just significant, but critical? We can think about this not by looking at complex economic formulas or statistics, but instead talking about the simplest of all mathematical operations, counting things. Surely something as ridiculously simple as counting comes as close to Pythagorean Platonic ideals of perfect numbers as we can in real life, right? Wrong! For if you hand a complete deck of cards to a dozen different people and ask them to count them up, I guarantee you that at least one person will tell you you've got one too many or a missing one. This is just an example of human frailty. The mind wanders, especially when doing repetitive tasks. You can get easily distracted, which is why kids have such fun screaming out random numbers when a parent or friend is trying to count something up. And some people are just plain better at this skill than others. This is why companies spend days doing warehouse inventories, because they don't trust people to get it correct the first time, and rather spend more time and money repeating the count over and over until they get what they believe is the quote-unquote correct numbers. Now scale this counting inventorying process up further to an exercise where you have to count millions of pieces of paper in multiple formats that each have different markings, that are collected at different places at different times and passed through multiple people's hands on the way to being tallied. Welcome, folks, to the 2000 presidential election. In fact, welcome to any election ever, for every one of them ultimately requires a vote to be tallied. And given that you'll get errors when you ask a dozen friends to count 52 identically sized and shaped playing cards, what are the chances you'll get even more errors in a count of millions of differently shaped, worded, and managed ballots? I'll tell you what it is. It's 100%. In fact, every election that's ever been held of any scale, I'm ignoring votes for classroom hall monitor where the votes of 30 elementary school students can be checked and double-checked accurately enough, there's been a margin of error of several hundred or several thousand votes. Normally, you don't take any notice of this problem because the size of the victory overwhelms this error factor to such a degree that it is irrelevant, just as the difference between 2 inches and 2.001 inches is irrelevant for most carpentry projects. But when the vote is close, i.e. when it is within this range of error, the whole system breaks down. And by breakdown, I mean 2000 election, hanging chads, who's really the president, courtroom battles, near-constitutional crisis levels of chaos. Think back to that vote. Much of this chaos arose from the fact that no one, not the candidates, not the media, not even the public, was willing to accept the fact that there might not be a quote-unquote accurate number lurking out there. If we could just put enough time and money into counting and recounting the ballots, we told ourselves, we'll get to this true number. 2 + 2 must equal 4, after all. At first, it was assumed that this problem resulted not from the human condition, but from unusual conditions related to Florida. The ballots were poorly designed, this politician or that was in someone's pocket, vote counters were given irrational directions, etc., etc. But even when states that learned lessons from Florida and made their balloting process more consistent and rational had a close vote, as Minnesota did during their 2008 Senate race, the same problem arose when the victory margin was within the margin of error. Keep in mind that I'm not talking about candidates and their lawyers trying to put their thumbs on the scale to tip the vote their way by including their supporters and excluding those of their opponents. That's just one more human factor to add to a mix which has already separated a mathematical operation that exists in the highly messy real world, counting ballots, from the metaphysical perfection that we believe numbers must possess. If we could bring ourselves to accept that finding the true, accurate, final number in any close vote involving complex balloting might not be possible, then we might make changes that can help us deal with the fact that there is mathematical ambiguity in the real world, changes such as requiring a do-over in such close elections, which could replace the current method for breaking a tie in many states, the flipping of a coin. But our devotion to the notion of mathematical perfection means we'll continue to spend millions of dollars and live in chaos, all to ensure we never have to admit that in some numerical situations, the answer might not exist. So just counting stuff can get us into this much trouble. What happens when we get into more complex mathematical matters like, say, polling? Nothing demonstrates our devotion to quantitative information better than our fascination with poll results, even from nonsense polls like the ones you could plug onto a web page these days without having to write a single line of code. When such polls are used to gauge innocent matters like ice cream preferences, there's little harm done. Whenever they're used to measure important political preferences, such as support for one presidential candidate versus another, their key flaw, lack of control over who gets the vote, becomes apparent. To cite two examples, I routinely get invitations emailed me to participate in ballot stuffing on this or that internet poll, and I've even heard of a presidential candidate who shall not be named paying his supporters to vote for him whenever his name appears on any poll found anywhere on the web. But what about professional polls that people pay thousands of dollars to have experts in survey techniques and statistics put together? Again, when you're dealing with uncontroversial subjects, such surveys are extraordinarily useful. They underlie a century of successful social science and market research, after all. But once you start talking about things like who's ahead and who's behind in a presidential race, or where the country stands on particular political issues, Our lack of understanding of what a poll is really saying, especially with regard to assumptions of accuracy, begin to bite. For instance, as Seif points out in Proofiness, every poll number contains something called a margin of error, often stated in the form of plus or minus some number, which alerts people to a statistical factor that says the quote-unquote actual number may be slightly more or slightly less than the number cited as the result of the poll. For example, if a poll says that candidate A is ahead of candidate B by 54 to 46%, with a margin of error of plus or minus 3, that would indicate that candidate A is likely to win, since even if you assume it's off by the largest margin of 3%, candidate A still wins 51 to 49. This statistical margin of error affects every poll, although it can be brought down by increasing your sample size. A poll of 1 million voters, for example, would have a smaller margin of error than the same poll given to just 1,000 people. We often take the statistical margin of error to be the only possible variation in poll results. In other words, we take it to be telling us the full range of possible inaccuracy in the poll. But there are all kinds of other reasons why the poll results you're reading might be telling you something wrong or meaningless. The sample size to stand in for the whole, for example, may have been chosen poorly, or the overall sample might be too small. Survey questions may have been confusing or intentionally designed to push people one way or another. People might lie to pollsters, or people with one political opinion may tend to hang up on telephone pollsters more often than others. The poll may have been designed before a major news story broke that changed the dynamic of the race. Or maybe someone paid to collect information screwed up the data entry, remember the human factor, or a PhD in statistics forgot to carry the two. Such systemic errors may only impact poll results slightly. But if you look at that candidate A and B example I just used, a 1 to 2% systemic error can mean the difference between who was winning and losing. And even if a scientific poll is done perfectly, whatever that means, remember that a poll is simply a snapshot of opinion at a particular point in time. But given how bad polls are at predicting the future, weren't they telling us last summer that Rick Perry was supposed to be the Republican nominee this election? We need to look at polls for what they are, just one more set of information that needs to be evaluated for quality, especially for timeliness. Just as the chaos of the 2000 Florida election was a result of our unwillingness to shake our faith in numbers, our belief in polling data also arises from the extraordinary belief we attach to quantitative information. And like any belief, our readiness to treat numerical data more respectfully than we treat other forms of information can be turned against us by those trying to get us to do what they want us to do. In fact, there are a number of ways numbers are used fallaciously in political argumentation. And since I was so hard on the Republicans during the first part of this podcast, if I pull examples from the current campaign, I'll make sure they're Democratic ones. My favorite is one Jay Heinrichs highlights, and thank you for arguing, called the unit fallacy. This is one you should always look out for when people talk about percentages or rates. Heinrichs uses the example of someone boasting that a company's profits are up 20%. Wow, you say. So since we made 10% profit last year, that means we're up to 30%? Actually, you're sheepishly told, we're only up to 12%. Since it wasn't our actual profits that grew 20%, but our profit percentage, which was 10% and grew 2%. In other words, that 20% is being applied to the 10%. 20% of 10% is 2%, rather than added to it, since growing by 20% sounds a lot better than up by 2%. See how that works? You see this all the time in budget politics, when someone shows off his or her fiscal responsibility by telling you, for example, that the rate of growth in government spending is lower during my administration than any other time in history. So the budget is smaller than when you came into office? No, it's bigger than ever. But it's not getting any bigger, right? Actually, it's still growing, so by definition, it's getting bigger. But it's getting bigger more slowly than it has in the past. Feeling like a sucker? Seif, in Proofiness, highlights a number of numeric fallacies that travel under fruity names, such as comparing apples to oranges. This is where you compare two things that sound similar but aren't. Like when President Obama boasted this summer that he had created more jobs during the last 27 months of his administration than his predecessor had in both terms combined. Pretty impressive. Unless you stop to ask why he chose to count just the last 27 months of his administration, ignoring most of his first 2 years in office. Might that be because these most recent months were the best ones for job creation during his term, meaning including previous months would drive his numbers down? And why compare that to Bush's entire term in office, unless comparing Obama's 27-month apple to Bush's 8-year orange gave him the numbers he needed to make a political point he wanted to make and, just as importantly, his supporters wanted to hear? The last example actually is a combination of two fruity fallacies. In addition to comparing apples and oranges, Obama is also guilty of cherry-picking, choosing just the data that serves his needs and ignoring numbers that don't do the job quite as well. You saw the same thing in a TV ad that attacked Mitt Romney's time as governor of Massachusetts, which the ad claimed fell to 47th state in the ranking of U.S. states with regard to job creation. Pretty damning. Unless you realize that when Romney took office, Massachusetts was totally in the tank and was thus the worst state, number 50 in terms of job creation. Ignoring the question of how you can fall from 50th to 47th place, 47th place is still pretty lousy. So doesn't that still demonstrate the governor's stinky record as a turnaround artist? Actually, by the time Romney left office, Massachusetts had risen to number 28 in this particular ranking. So where did that 47 come from? It came from calculating job creation over the course of Romney's entire 4 years in office, which masks the more relevant fact, an improving trend, by using an average instead of looking at more meaningful year-over-year improvement. These last two examples also demonstrate the problem that numbers rarely tell you everything you need to know to understand a complex story. Job creation statistics, for instance, may not provide the economic context in which those statistics played out. Massachusetts, for example, is impacted by the ups and downs of the high-tech industry more than other states. So it could drop to last in the nation or jump from 50 to 47 or 28 based primarily on how the global tech economy is doing, something that may or may not have much to do with who's sitting in the governor's office. Similarly, any statistics regarding the economic performance of a president or his predecessor needs to take into account and include information on when an economic recession may have begun and ended during either administration or before an administration took office. Generally, whenever you hear a complex situation explained with a simple, stunning number, watch out, even if, actually especially if, you're inclined to like the candidate or believe in the issue which such a stunning number supports. That's because proofiness is generally used to convince allies by giving them misleading numbers that support what they already believe. In other words, it's a particularly powerful and pernicious way of playing to someone's confirmation bias. For instance, last year we were treated to such a stunning number that came from a White House report announcing that, despite all of the advances made by women in the workforce over the last several decades, women were still earning 75 cents for every dollar earned by a man, a huge discrepancy that demonstrated the continuation of gender discrimination in the workplace. Or did it? In this case, there are a number of confounding factors that provided reasonable explanations for some of this 25% factor, such as the way the report broadly grouped professions so that highly paid surgeons, where men still predominate, and lower paid pediatricians, which is about 50-50 men and women, were all grouped together under the category physicians to demonstrate gender pay disparity within a field. Then you had failures to build in factors such as how choices and timing regarding balancing work and family can play out when calculating averages that span the long period between graduation and retirement. I link to an article in the www.criticalvoter.com website that goes into more detail on these numbers. But as you read that analysis or just listen to my briefer version, note that criticism of numbers in the report does not mean women are not discriminated against in the workplace or that the need to fight against such discrimination should not continue. But it does mean that anyone who feels this way should take extra care not to build their case on a powerful-sounding statistic that could easily be discredited because it's a form of proofiness. For as with most confirmation bias problems, this could end up undermining the very cause you think you're championing. While I may have chosen democratic examples to illustrate different types of mathematical deception, you could easily find similar mathematical sleight of hand in Republican ads and talking points. In fact, the way we usually deal with getting caught engaging in proofiness is to use another fallacy, the two-coquet fallacy, which translates as you also or you another. Yep, this is the so's your old man fallacy, which tries to get out of being caught pulling a fast one by pointing out that your opponent does the same thing, something especially appropriate for mathematical fallacies since every politician uses a form of trickery all the time. Like most ad hominem attack fallacies, this one can be both handy and fun since it lets you turn from defender to attacker without having to admit you got caught trying to mislead, either willingly or inadvertently. But it's not that useful if you're trying to actually get to the truth, which, as we've been talking about during our entire discussion of background knowledge, is the ultimate goal of critical thought. Given the power numbers will continue to have over us, both to inform and deceive, we must resist the urge to cast away our critical eye when numerical information is invoked. For numbers are just another form of information, subject to all of the tests for evaluating information we looked at in our discussion of information literacy. Is this numerical information accurate? Is it biased? Is it timely, relevant, and sufficient? The same quality control steps you take to double-check any information need to be applied to numbers, with special emphasis on keeping your eye open to some of the mathematical tricks we just discussed. While this might take a bit more work than just accepting numbers that support your cause and rejecting those that don't, The choices you make can mean the difference between being a slave to your own confirmation biases and being a truly free critical thinker. So that's going to wrap up our discussion of numbers. And with that out of the way, I'd like to announce a few program notes. First, as we head into the home stretch of the election, I'll be shifting gears from introducing new subjects to demonstrating how subjects we've been discussing are playing out in the actual campaign. This will give you a chance to experience the practical impact of various persuasive techniques and the critical thinking skills needed to understand them. It'll also give me the chance to introduce you to more examples of things like fallacies and figures of speech as they're used by one or more of the candidates out in the hustings, such as the cliche, on the hustings. If anyone out there knows what the hustings are, please let me know. Second, and this I'm most excited about, I'm planning to have guests join us on as many of the remaining podcasts as I can, guests who can provide us their own take on the subject we've been learning about. And I'm thrilled to say our first guest will be one of the most interesting and thoughtful people working in this field, a person I've turned to and pointed you towards many times during this podcast, Kevin DeLaplante from Critical Thinker Academy. So please join me next time on a very special Critical Voter podcast.